Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Hamilton, and today we have a great show for you because we have two exciting guests, and I think if all of you out there, if you've ever dreamed of owning and operating a restaurant and doing your own thing, this is the show for you. Today we have Michael Chernow and Daniel Holzman, who are the guys who opened the meatball shops in 2010. They opened one meatball shop, took the city by storm. They now have three meatball shops and getting ready to open another in Chelsea. And their story is a fabulous one, and it's going to make you so jealous. So first of all, I want to say hi, Daniel. Hi, Michael. Welcome.
Hey there.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show. So, this is a real partnership, right? You two have known each other a long time.
Chop chop, partnership for sure.
So it's good for him. It's good for me.
So this partnership goes back to high school, huh?
Yeah, we met when we were 13. It was kind of an arranged marriage.
Right.
Dan and I, our mothers, both kind of worked in the same field and very close to each other. Actually, my mother went to the doctor that Daniel worked for, and Daniel's mother went to the dentist that my mother worked for. And
let's keep it medical.
Keep it medical, all medical. They got to talking, and Daniel was already at LaGuardia. He was a freshman at LaGuardia. I was
LaGuardia High School LaGuardia on High the School. Upper West Side. Is that the Fame High School?
That is.
Mike played the tuba.
Did you no? Because you, it's a very, very hard high school to get into, and
not
you have
if you're
to be
the only person that plays the tuba. Then it's pretty easy.
Oh, come on! Tell me.
Why do you always downplay my tuba?
I'm a
tubist.
Did you have to audition to get in that high school?
Certainly.
All right.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
He's not a small person. He's like a regular sized human now, but for some reason he was a very small person at the time, and the tuba was just amazingly enormous. It was like this enormous instrument, just was bigger than him, and but he played it.
Really, the tuba was kind of put in my lap. But Dan,
literally,
was a flautist.
Yeah, yeah.
My gosh,
I can actually dance and play the flute simultaneously.
We'll
and
call
I
you
could,
Puck.
Yeah, I could. I had like a geese that would follow me.
The Pied Piper. I introduced Dan.
This
to
is on the Upper East Side where you both grew up, right?
We grew up on the Upper East Side.
Right.
He grew up on 87th and 2nd, and I grew up on 83rd and 1st, and we'd meet in the middle.
So, did you meet in high school?
Oh yeah.
Okay, right, so even right though before. You both came from the Upper East Side. All right, so now, does music play a big role in your restaurants?
Music plays a very large role in our restaurants. When I was, for the first year that we were open, Dan and I didn't leave the restaurant for even a second. It was kind of frustrating for the staff because I was so tied to the music. And now kind of everybody has this idea and understands the kind of music that I like, which is predominantly the music that Dan likes and kind of everybody else.
What kind of music is that?
it's a wide range, but it starts, you know, we say Billie Holiday to Biggie Smalls. That's kind of the way we describe it, you know. It's and everything in between, so, you know.
Okay, so everybody wants to know the road you took to get where you are today. So you started out playing the flute and the tuba, and you wound up making meatballs. So where do we start? Who started in the hospitality industry first?
Oh, man, we both got our first job. No, I worked at the Mexican restaurant.
Dan got a job at Sam Alita's first. And then when we were...
How old?
Maybe 12 years old. Yeah. They went out of business, though, so it's okay.
I got a... Yeah, and then...
I was delivering burritos on the Upper East Side. It was pretty...
I was Dan got me a job. He got a job at the Candle Cafe. I guess he was 13.
With Joy and Bart.
Is that vegan? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he asked me if I wanted a job. I was delivering videos at Couch Potato right down the street.
Uh-huh.
And I said, sure, I'll hop on the old wagon. And
Mike was incredible. He was so fast because he had rollerblades. He would deliver on rollerblades, and everybody was jealous of him because he could do more deliveries than anybody. He could. He was making all the tips. Yeah.
So this was from the Candle Cafe.
From the Candle Cafe.
So did you two love food, or was this just because you wanted a job?
I think it was definitely at that stage, it was because we wanted money in our pocket. But, you know, it really kind of turned into something special, you know.
Because Daniel, you got a full scholarship to the CIA, did you not?
I did. While I was working at the Candle Cafe, a friend of ours, her father was the maitre d' of Le Bernardin, and so he kind of saw us working over there and got me a job working at Le Bernardin in the kitchen because I told him I was interested in cooking. So it wound up being...
You got a job... How old were you?
I was maybe 14.
14, you got a job at Le Bernardin. Many people would kill for this. Wow, how long did you work there?
Maybe four and a half years or 5 years or so.
5 years at Le Bernardin. Was this special. Under Gilbert Lacoste?
No,
Eric?
He had just passed away a few months ago, but a few months prior. But yeah, the skills I learned at Le Bernardin translate directly to meatballs.
I'm sure you're not joking.
I'm not, but it's kind of funny.
Wow. So
I still haven't been able to pull off a fishball, you know.
We have gone through
the standard is so high if you worked Bernadette. But what were you going to say, Michael?
Just the fishball thing doesn't really translate well.
No.
Although the Asians do it really well.
Yeah.
And why don't we just get in touch with those guys?
Just call up Asia.
Well, that's when you open your shop in Chinatown.
Right.
Right.
Well, but it's the most expensive
real estate we were talking about before. Okay. So was it from Le Bernardin to CIA?
It was from Le Bernardin to Paladin. At Paladin, I did my
Jean-Louis.
Externship. Yeah, from Jean-Louis, I did my externship at the CIA.
Wow.
And then it was San Francisco bound or Vegas or something.
So and you went
LA.
You worked at Aqua
Jardiniere, the fifth floor in the Canton Place, and just fancy place, fancy restaurants, mostly fancy restaurants.
Why'd you go out west?
I really desperately wanted to leave New York so badly. I just wanted to see something else, and I wanted to go to New Orleans. That's what I really wanted to do. I still want to live there.
Why didn't you go then?
Because I was working in the city at Paladin, and he said, you know, do you want to come and work at my restaurant in Las Vegas? And I just said, yes.
Oh, so you went to Las Vegas, too.
So I lived in Las Vegas, yeah.
What was that like?
It was like I was 19 and not the most healthy lifestyle for a 19-year-old boy by himself. I had a motorcycle without a license, and, you know, I was very conservative. I think of myself as very conservative because amongst
the original Easy Rider.
Why do you think of yourself as?
I just think of myself as a really conservative person, but that's just because my friends are less conservative. Uh-huh. Realistically, I guess I don't know.
You're a bit adventurous.
Adventurous.
I would categorize you as adventurous.
I'm just scared the whole time.
You're very scared.
I'm just scared while I adventure.
You're a scared adventurer.
All right, so that's I wouldn't say a typical route, but that's an understandable route to getting into the restaurant business. Michael, you're different. You had a different route. You kind of went to even more the I don't want to say seedy lifestyle, but
you could say seedy.
Seedy lifestyle. Tell me when did you start getting exposed to the not so finer things in life?
Well, I I'm kind of I'm a real people person, so I gravitated towards the front of the house right off the bat, and they gave me a job as a busboy. At Joy and Bart Candle Cafe. Mm-hmm. And so I started bussing tables there, and then I found out that I really enjoyed that like hustle bustle of running around and doing it, and being the youngest guy by far was just fun for me. And so I was able to landed in you know most jobs as the youngest by 10 years. And so I knew somebody who worked in a nightclub, and she was like, you know, I kind of hung out with older people when I was young because probably of the restaurant business. But when I was 14, 15 years old, I had a friend who was working in a nightclub, and she got me a job, you know, doing flyers. And then when I was 16, I got offered a job as a barback, and I started kind of really working in the nightclubs. At Life.
And that's like the hottest club in the city. Everybody wanted to get in. Mike was 15 years old, just there.
Yeah.
At 15, you were at La Bernardin and you were at Life.
Right.
You had it all.
Yeah, it was fun.
So were you? It hasn't gotten any better. That was it. That was the pinnacle.
Yeah. No.
Did
but,
he ever
you know,
cook for you when he was that age?
You know, funny enough, there's some great stories. So we were, you know, Dan would come home on, you know, there was this one kid who we were friends with, and his parents just let us kind of like party at his house. And Dan would show up.
I think there were a couple of friends like that.
Well, Dan was definitely, you know, Dan's apartment was really a party hangout too. But I moved out of my parents' house when I was very young. I moved out when I was 15.
Wow.
I just was kind of like a rebel.
Where'd you go live?
All over the place.
Yeah, these two.
Your parents
college
must have been apoplectic.
I moved in with a couple of college girls.
He moved in
really?
With a couple of college girls.
I did. Yeah.
Oh, and this is getting saucier and saucier.
It's a saucy story. I mean, I don't know how censored this show is.
No, it isn't. You know, we're on internet. We can say whatever.
Great. So yeah. So I was exposed to, you know, the bad news very, very young, and so I just kind of ran with it. And I was kind of like a nomad around the city. I just bounced around, and you know, though it probably wasn't the greatest experiences for a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid, it, you know, taught me a lot. It taught me a lot of how to adapt and how to be a chameleon. And
how much money were you making at 15 to support yourself?
You know, I mean, I was, we are on the internet, right?
Right. I'm not going to ask about the
right.
the specificity.
Yeah,
right.
But I was where probably, you sourced the money.
I was probably making, you know, at 15, 16 years old, I was making, you know, $1,000 a week, something like that.
And he wasn't,
and you weren't,
he wasn't,
you weren't
paying
filing
taxes,
right?
Yeah, I wasn't paying any taxes. So out of all of our friends, Dan, you know, Dan and I always had a job, but out of all of our friends, Dan and I were probably the brokest as far as family's concerned. But when it came to like a personal level, I always had money. Always. I never didn't have money.
What age did you start working?
I started working at 12 years old. I mean, if I was going to talk about dog walking years, I mean, I started walking every single dog on my block when I was 10 years old. I put signs up in every single laundry room in the buildings up and down the street, and I would sneak into the buildings. I'd, you know, put a sign up, you know, with my phone number on it, and you know, I was kind of up to making money from a very young age.
So business to you is really intuitive.
I think it just kind of comes naturally. You know, I'm not like the greatest guy. I'm not the greatest financial guy. I'm not the greatest tax guy. I mean, you know, I have Dan for that, which is awesome. But as far as like ambition and going out and doing it and not just talking about it, that's kind of, you know, it's kind of like it's part of my DNA. I mean, it runs in my blood for whatever reason.
Okay, so you were in the clubs.
So I was in the clubs. Yeah, I started working in clubs, and then when I did the clubs for about 3 years, and then when I was 19 years old, I moved out to LA with Dan. We both moved out there, and I worked in a couple of restaurants out there. And then
were you doing in the restaurants? Front of house or back?
Front of house. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to New York because LA was just a complete nightmare for me. I mean, I was a maniac at that stage in my life. And so,
nightmare meaning partying.
partying, crashing cars, just being a real, you know, nuisance.
Fun guy, yeah. Actually. just completely, genuinely awesome, fun guy.
Fun. At 19 years old, I was the life of the party for sure. And then I moved back to New York, and I got my first, or not my first, but I got a restaurant gig. And I opened up a restaurant in Soho called Wule Yoke as the opening bartender there. And I bartended there, and it was actually really fun for me because I learned about a cuisine that I knew nothing about.
Which was Korean.
And I really got into Korean food, and I really enjoyed that. And I worked there, and then I just started working in restaurants. And then I worked at a wine bar. I was heavily into wine. I really enjoyed wine. And so I worked at a wine bar, and I learned a lot about wine, and I was able to really be a part of that project in the Lower East Side. When Clinton Street was kind of like when 71 Fresh Food was there and when Wiley just opened up. And so there was this wine bar called Punch and Judy, and it was a great place. And then after that, I got offered a job at Frank Restaurant, which was like the hottest restaurant in the East Village. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to go work over there. And I bartended there, and I stayed there for 8 years, working in that restaurant. And that's, that restaurant was where.
Did you stay there because you were making so much money, or did you stay there because you just liked it?
It was an atmosphere that I really enjoyed. I loved, absolutely loved the food. And
They never fired me.
They never fired me. The money was incredible, but I actually really loved the food. I mean, the experience that you would get at that restaurant, as you know, if I was taking care of you, was very different than the experience that you get at that restaurant when the rest of the people were taking care of you, because I really knew every single ingredient in every single dish, how it was prepared, all the wine. I loved my job there, and I really did, and it was a great place. And so I stayed there, and that restaurant was actually where I put together the initial group of guys that believed in us to open up the meatball shop.
So they were clients of that?
They were regulars.
They were regulars.
And I had been talking to them for the last, you know, 4 years, because, you know, really not until I was 24 did I really want to do this.
Oh, my God, such a late age.
Yeah. But I was 24 years old. I said to Dan, I was like, you know, man, I'm gonna come back to New York. I'm going to go to culinary school. I'm going to open up a restaurant. And as soon as I'm ready for it, I'm calling you. And I did it.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. We'll come back in a minute, and we're going to pursue the meatball shop.
Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guests are Michael Chernow and Daniel Holtzman from The Meatball Shop, two incredible entrepreneurs who are really setting the standard in New York for, you want to have a hot restaurant, if you want to do it right, you got to look at The Meatball Shop. Wow. So these are two boys that we're not going to dig too much into their past because I think my daughter might be listening to this. I don't want role models here of how to open a successful restaurant. But we're going to move right along to, so you're working at Frank. Daniel, when he's working at Frank, where are you?
I was in California for the most part, but I used to come back to New York all the time. And it was a funny experience because, what's up?
Speaking to the mic, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, this is me.
I would come back to New York and... I would eat at Frank every single time I come back to New York, you know, for the free food. and I never knew that they had a menu for the until very recently. I didn't even realize they had a menu because you'd sit down at the bar and Mike would tell you what you were going to eat, and he would do that to everybody, and he knew every single person that would come into the restaurant. It was amazing. Everybody that would walk through the door, he knew their name. And if they had been there once before, or, you know, were a regular, they were going to be a regular because, you know, he made them feel like they were special. And if they were bringing a date, they could feel like, you know, they were the coolest person, because it was a hard place to get into. But everybody found a seat around the bar. And there were 11 seats at the bar?
11 seats.
11 seats
actually
at the bar.
11 seats and 3 deuces across the bar.
But he managed to get a lot of people sat down and fed and taken care of. And everybody loved him. I remember twice a year he'd have a birthday. He had a big thing. You know, Mike Chernow's birthday, and you have a big tip jar out.
When times are tough, it'd be a three-year.
Three times a year, yeah. Or I remember when the second time he moved to L.A., he had a big thing. Mike's moving to L.A., and there had to be $1,000 in that jar.
There was a lot of dough in the jar.
Yeah.
Hey.
Mike moved to L.A.
How many jars do you have in your meatball shop?
Unfortunately, no jars.
No jars.
We believe in a slightly more structured management system.
Okay, so now how did the two of you get the money? You just walked up to your regulars and said,
you know,
how did
I've
you
been,
figure out how much money you needed? How did you find your first location? And
the story is, you know, I've been talking to these guys for a really long time about, you know, this idea that I was going to open up my own thing, and that kind of was, you know, it wasn't meatballs for. Until the very end, actually.
Really?
Yeah, the meatballs thing was a complete kind of spoof. But, you know, I had been talking to these guys about opening a restaurant, and I've been talking to them.
Were they Wall Street types?
They were finance guys.
They're all different guys, though.
The original crew was finance guys, and then, you know, as it became more real and real, I started asking more and more people. And then, of course, you know, Dan's brother and Dan was in business with his brother and 2 other guys, and they were on board. So, you know, we had a bunch of great people that believed in us. So, believe it or not, finding the money was not hard for us, even though it was our first venture. And it was actually really, really nice to know that we had support there. We didn't know how much money we needed, but we had enough. So that was great.
How much did it cost to open your first restaurant?
We raised $390,000, and we opened it for $350 and kept $40 in the bank. $340 and kept $50 in the bank, but we had full blown projections and business plan.
We weren't sure exactly how much it was going to cost. You know, I mean, it was scary. It was the first time we'd opened up a restaurant. You know, Dan and I did all the work.
Construction.
All of it. Yeah, Dan knew a lot more about it than I did, so he would just kind of tell me what to do. But it was, it was a really challenging time, I think. You know, opening up a restaurant is scary, you know. But the way it kind of came about was, you know, we had this other idea, and we knew that we wanted to open up a restaurant that was, originally it was like a $45 check average. It was going to sit down, you know, kind of eat what the chef is cooking kind of place. And we started looking for restaurants for it. And this one restaurant that we found that we were very close to making a deal on, thank God that deal fell through. But this restaurant had a little side window, and it was on Bleecker Street, and it was just east of the subway on the east side. And, you know, that side window was also right next to a very busy bar. So there's always people hanging outside of the bar. And Dan and I, while we were kind of, you know, making the deal on the restaurant, we said, well, how are we going to feed those people that are outside of the bar without having them come into the restaurant completely hammered? So we were kind of walking around the East Village, Lower East Side, seeing what people were eating late night. We wanted to do something quick, something simple, something easy, right out of that side window. And, you know, I, at Frank Restaurant, would eat my meal almost every night was a bowl of the meatballs that they made there and the red sauce, which was incredible, a side of broccoli and a side of spinach and some beets. That's what I ate every night. And so when we were walking around, and, you know, I just said, how about meatballs? And Dan said, smart. So we kind of you know, the meatballs thing was part of this other restaurant that we had sort of conceptualized. And, but, you know, once we started cooking the meatballs, people really started the conversation at the table for potential investors. We would have all these investor dinners at my house on Sunday nights. And the conversation at the table was like really sort of gravitating towards the meatballs more than anything else. And, you know, kind of like by the grace of the powers that be, the restaurant fell through. And Dan and I remember we were sitting at Whole Foods. We were ready to pull each other's hair out, or he was ready to pull my hair out, I should say. And you know, we were really kind of at wit's end because, you know, we had lost a couple of deals already. And like we both kind of looked at each other and we just, you know, we said meatballs at the same time, kind of, you know, not really like that, but that's kind of how it happened. And that's what we did. We dove right into the meatballs thing, and we invited the investors over, and we cooked all these different meatballs and all these different sides, and then we wrote a business plan. And this was kind of what spawned the meatball shop, that little side window on Bleecker Street. And yeah, we wrote the business plan, we sent it out. And
how much money did you ask from each of the investors?
20 grand, 25 grand.
Oh. 20 grand.
20 so grand.
You, had, it was 14, you have a lot right. of investors.
It was 14, yeah. $20,000 shares. But we got a couple of subscriptions for 30,000 and then a couple for less.
Yeah.
The it was a really good piece of advice. Somebody said, because we were going to just offer whatever people would give, and someone came along and said, no, you should definitely make a minimum because, you know, then you'll have a more structured approach.
Is it better to have more investors than one investor?
It's an argument.
It's an argument. You know, the original idea was to have a lot of investors because I knew so many people in so many different industries. So I wanted to have sort of a collective group of guys and gals that that would talk to their, you know, specific industry and say, hey, you know, I'm part of this thing, come to the restaurant. I'm part of this thing, come to the restaurant. And it actually worked out really well. You know, but as you grow, I think it just makes it cleaner and easier to work with one guy or one gal. You know, that's the financial partner. But you know,
so how you had the concept in your head that you're going to have your own restaurant. You've been working in the industry forever now. So what surprised you when you did have your own restaurant? Was it everything you expected, or were there like, ooh, I didn't know about that, or wow, I didn't expect that?
You know, this road is not, there's no straight road. So there, you know, I think we both had we're open-minded about having, of changing as we went along. So I don't think we were so much surprised as just constantly changing, coming up with new ideas, trying stuff out, figuring it out, whether it worked, immediately losing it. The most surprising thing is how similar to our original concept it still is. And that it was a pretty solid idea, and we didn't really need to completely throw the whole thing out. Because the idea is to try and be super rigid and make sure that you're standing behind your philosophy, but also be willing to say, ooh, this is going in the wrong direction. Let's fix it right away.
We, you know, I think from the get-go, the original idea was a counter service restaurant. That was actually how we originally wanted to do it, because I didn't want to have to deal with, I'd come from a place where, you know, dealing with waiters and bartenders and stuff like that, getting, you know, drunk and stealing. And I'm not saying that that was what it was like at the restaurant that I was at, but I'd known from working in the industry that is just a reality, you know. And so my original idea was like, let's can all that and have a bartender, a counter person, and some busboys and do it that way. And so when we opened up the restaurant, the first night for friend and family, that was the idea. It was like you walk in, you wait online, there was a takeout counter, you order your food, you get a number, you sit down at the table, we bring the food out for you. And, you know, the night that we opened, we didn't know how many people were standing outside because there was still paper in the windows. So Dan and I were kind of standing there, and, you know, he is a real skeptic and I'm a real sort of optimist. And he was like, 80% chance this is not going to work. And I was like, 80% chance this is going to work.
And Mike has finally found a word that doesn't hurt. Like, you used to call me a pessimist, and I really didn't like that. But skeptic, I feel so proud of skeptic. You know, optimist versus skepticism.
Skeptic is more like a scientist.
I feel like, you know, skeptic. Oh, yeah. Intelligence.
So, all right. So how many – I want to know – what happened? How many people were out there?
Well, there was a line around the block. And
wow! And were these your... How did people know about it?
Oh, the New York Times.
Yeah, the New York Times. You Florence Fabricant's incredible.
We got three articles before we opened, and then they slammed us in our opening review, which was great.
Oh, now tell me, but why did you get? How did you get three articles? Everybody in the world wants three articles in the New York Times.
I think that we, well, first of all, we had a PR company, so that was definitely why.
Is that an important thing to do?
Huge.
I think that's really important.
Don't make the mistake. Do it.
Okay.
And then we had a really, just luckily, we had a really good story because we were, and it's a true story. So we were best friends from high school who always had a dream of opening a restaurant together, and I think people can kind of get behind that. I know that if somebody told me that story, I would want to go and support them and try that out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, ideally you come to the restaurant and the food's good. So you say, wow, I want to come back. And then, you know, you get a great experience. And I think we were just so lucky on so many levels when we first opened up with the timing and the
so lucky.
Economy was poor. So and
2010, you know, most people would not say that was a lucky time.
It was
people
great.
Thought we were crazy.
Because the economy was tough. This was a date that you could afford that was still cool. I mean, there aren't too many restaurants where you can take a first date and not feel like a cheapskate and get out for under, you know, $25 or $30 in the city. But here you can have a glass of wine and you know, a meal. And
a delicious meal.
Hopefully a delicious meal in a really comfortable, super cool environment. You know, the other thing is the whole waiting online thing, which I never really understood, but you know, let's say we're going out and for a few bucks we can get a drink next door and you can extend an evening to, you know, 2-3 hours between waiting in line and, you know, by the time you've got your meatballs,
like your
you're
style.
Drunk and then you get out of the restaurant.
I like your style.
Yeah.
You know, that's that realistically, and I know it's a complete luxury problem, but our number one issue at our restaurants is that at between 7:30 and 9:30 at night, for a party of three or more, it's a 2.5 hour wait. And so
I was standing in the door at Stanton Street and this couple came in and they said, you know, how long is the wait? And the lady said 2.5 hours and I felt so terrible for these two. I was like, 2.5 hours, it's 7 o'clock. Imagine if you went to dinner. I would be angry and hungry.
Yes.
In 2.5 hours, and my date would not go
well. We have a policy at the restaurant. So at 45 minutes, everybody that's waiting gets meatballs. So we just bring plates of meatballs out forever.
I was going to say there's got to be a little Michael Chernow selling those people on the line with the entrepreneurial.
We send out balls for everybody, and you know we've helped out all the neighboring businesses, actually. You know, they did an article in the Times that said, you know, they interviewed Eric from Epstein's, the bar next door. And the first year that we opened up that restaurant, sales were up 30% at Epstein's.
Wow.
And they, we you know, they're amazing guys. I mean, they are an extension of the meatball shop. You know,
When we were looking at the corner, it was like, I was like, I don't know, it's kind of a quiet block. And Mike goes, what are you talking about? Epstein's is right next door. And everybody I'd talk to, they'd say, where are you? You'd say, oh, we're right next to Epstein's.
Yeah.
Everybody got it. And down the block is a pizzeria that's, you know, been there
Rosario's
forever. Rosario's. And that's a staple.
I was very, very particular when it came to looking for the first location. I knew I had, for whatever reason, I had the plan in my head of how this thing was going to go and where I wanted to be. And it was difficult for Dan, I'm sure, because I had spent the last 15 years in the Lower East Side in the East Village. You know, like that's where I lived in Lower East Side. I worked in Lower East Side. And I knew exactly where I wanted to be. And it was not a large plot of land. I mean, it was, you know, a 2-block radius. And the inventory wasn't like abundant down there. So I just was very specific. And Dan would say, well, why can't we just go, you know, a couple of blocks that way? And I was like, because I've got this thing, you know. And that restaurant was actually, I walked past it 1,000 times when I was looking for restaurants because it was a lot bigger. And it was a much bigger bite than we had originally anticipated in opening this place. We wanted to, like, the model that I kind of looked at was like B&H or the Stage Diner on 2nd Avenue between 7th and 8th Street. It's just like a counter and a kitchen. And
or Mikey's Burgers on
Mikey's Burgers, right. And, you know, we when I brought Dan there, you know, somebody had shown me the store, and I said, you know, guy walked in there, and I was like, oh, my God, I got that feeling. And it's funny when you get that feeling, but it happens every time, you know, when we make a decision on a restaurant. We both walk in, and we're just like, Okay, this is a meatball shop.
We literally look at each other and just go, yep, meatball shop. You feel it.
There was one place that we did that. We had that feeling, and we walked away from that deal because it was a little bit
expensive.
But, you know,
the guy had the shakes. He had the shakes. He was distracting us with shaking around while he was talking fast through his mouth.
But we walked in there, you know, and I knew, and I knew that that was the store, and it was definitely more expensive than what we could afford at the time. But I was able to convince Daniel to do it.
I don't know how.
Which location is this?
This is the first one on Stanton Street. So it's and you know, it's as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know if that restaurant's just an anomaly or it was just I don't know what it is, but that footprint. That exact restaurant. When I walk in there, now we have a bigger restaurant in Brooklyn, you know, and I love that restaurant. I mean, it's awesome. I feel like that's the most beautiful of our restaurants in Brooklyn. But, you know, when I walk into Stanton Street, I just if I can produce that exact store and just drop them in places, I would do that, and that would be it. I would just do that because that's. The floor, the dining room is 500 square feet. There's 39 seats. We'll do 1,000 covers on a Saturday there.
Oh, my gosh. All right, wait. We got to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to mine this genius you have.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guests are Daniel Hoseman and Michael Chernow from The Meatball Shop. And we've just gone through their extraordinary debut. But I'm going to say, how many employees do you have now?
We're creeping up on 200.
You have three shops, three restaurants,
mm-hmm.
And you're open 7 days a week?
7 days a week, Sunday through Thursday, 12 noon till 2 a.m., and Friday and Saturday, 12 noon till 4 a.m.
Woo! And how much do the both of you work?
I have no idea how often I work. I really don't know. I was thinking about it the other day. I was like, I just don't know. I feel like I don't work at all. I feel very lazy sometimes. But
because
I can't
you
tell
love what you do?
And like, what's working? When you're sitting in bed until 10 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning writing emails, is that working? I mean, do most people just do their emails at their desk and then? Because when you are in the business, in the restaurant business, you're in the restaurant. But then there's all the business stuff. You also have to deal with. So I don't know. How does that work?
I think it's, you know, it's actually still the biggest challenge for me because, you know, when I think of work, I mean, work is going to a place, setting up something, you know, being a technician and closing it down and going home like that. It's been so many years that's been my job. And so, you know.
Are we working right now?
We're working.
Oh, are you working?
Yeah. That's the crazy.
Your PR company would tell you.
Wouldn't you feel guilty about that? I mean, how?
You know, my day starts at, I wake up very early. I'm an early riser, so I wake up very early. And I start emails at, you know, I start my emailing at like 7:30 in the morning.
There's a 2-hour period when there aren't emails coming for, because I go to sleep at 4 and then he wakes up at 6. So between 4 and 6, our staff doesn't receive emails.
Yeah, we, you know, I think. I have to learn and understand, and especially now, you know, for him, it's a lot easier. I have a wife. So, you know, when I'm, in my mind, emailing, just because I've been working so long, emailing is not work. I don't really consider sitting down at my...
You don't think you should get paid for that?
Well, I think it's more like I'm just so used to working with my hands
right.
that, like, sitting in front of the computer for hours doesn't really compute as work to me.
Right.
So... But for my wife, it certainly does.
Okay, so let's, yes, of course. Let's segue, you know, Daniel, you're a trained chef. Michael, you are a professional front of house operator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it take to be the owner, proprietor, manager? How is that different? How do you prepare for it? You know, what are the demands? Are you doing it like Danny Meyer in Union Square Hospitality Group does it? I mean, now you're starting to clone yourself and you have 200 people. How do you give them the group hug?
You know, I think I took a number of pages from Danny Meyer's book, Setting the Table. I mean, that guy's like my actual icon, and all his whole team has really been so supportive of the meatball shop. Dan and I mean, they take meetings with us whenever we ask, which is awesome. But yeah, I think the general philosophy for us is put your staff first and everything else falls into place. And when you put your staff first and I'm very friendly with everybody that works for me, and I have a number of techniques as to how to kind of talk to people and tell them that they're not doing an incredible job sometimes, without making me look like a complete asshole. Daniel just takes the hand.
I'm just like,
but you know, I'm not. I think the number one.
Who's more effective?
Well, we're both very effective. I think he's more effective long term, and I think short term, like if I say jump, people jump. If he says jump, people might not jump right then and there, but they'll probably get the job done and be happy about
it. Interesting.
Well, I think there's actually the difference is like when I say jump, people do it with a smile, and when Dan says jump, people might do it a little quicker, pissed
faster
off,
faster and hard, and they will jump their ass off.
But you know, I think for us, really, what we've learned is, for me anyway, you know. Having a line drawn in the sand. I'm not friends with anybody that works at the meatball shop. I'm friendly with everybody, and I have a great relationship. But I really, I'm very conscious and cognizant of staying on my side of the street, because I know that once you step over that line, it's very, very hard to come back.
How did you learn that?
Be his partner. His best friend and partner. He was like, if I have to deal with one more person that I have to be friends with, I'm over it.
Yeah, I just know that it's just so much easier for me to be somewhat, you know, diligent with people. If I have that boundary, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't look down upon people that go out and, mm-hmm. you know, hang out and drink with the staff or the drink, you know. Mm. But like for me, it's a philosophy that I stick to, because it's really, really proved great results. Right. You know.
So tell me, what about, who do you have to surround yourself with these days? Lawyers, finance guys, accountants, PR people. I mean, can you just have a fun restaurant?
You can just have a fun restaurant. It just depends upon what your goal is. You know, if we had one restaurant, you know, it would be a very different landscape. And if we had three restaurants, but we didn't want to open more restaurants, that would be a different landscape as well. If you're expanding, if you're growing, you have to dress for the job you want, and you have to plan ahead and be, you know, or hopefully you do that. So you have to be a little bit thoughtful. But it's not like we're some sort of giant corporate, you know, behemoth with you know, layers of red tape that we have to strip away if we want to go to the bathroom or something. It's just regular.
Do you have plans to expand outside of New York?
We don't have plans to. We talk about it all the time. And
all
it's
the time.
A big question, you know.
Where would you do it?
That's the question.
That's the question.
That's the number one.
The problem with something that we have is that we're really lucky and it's really successful and it's wonderful. And I could completely see, Mike and I could both completely see a meatball shop on the University of Wisconsin campus, or right in the middle of Los Angeles, or in Paris, or it doesn't. You
Austin,
can see the meatball shop
Philly,
working
DC.
Somewhere.
I mean, you could really see it. I think that's the kind of the beauty of our brand, is that, you know, nobody is afraid of a meatball, and you drop a meatball in front of anybody internationally, and they know what it is. So, like that, I think that the accessibility is there for anyone and everyone, which is beautiful. You know,
the hardest decisions are the decisions that don't have an obvious
right
answer.
I think also kind of like the greatest part about our success is that neither of us have changed. We, you know, people kind of think of the meatball shop guys as these two young dudes that are just that kind of like somehow hit the freaking lottery, but not like financially, but just like in the restaurant industry, you know, to open up a restaurant that's successful is challenging. And for us, I think, you know, we are ourselves. We do not pretend to be anybody else. And, you know, and
don't you think that's part of the success, that when you walk in your restaurants, there's real soul there. It's not fake.
I hope so.
You could feel there. I remember asking Alice Waters, what do you look for when you go to a restaurant? And she says, I just want to feel like someone's home. Mm-hmm. You know, they can botch the food a little bit. Maybe the service is slow, but I have to feel that there's passion there and someone really cares about this place, and it's an expression.
You know, there's a few restaurants, there's many restaurants, but you know, what I kind of love in the restaurant, and maybe it's just from years and years of working in restaurants, but there's a sound and a noise in a restaurant that's doing something right. And you know, funny enough, I went to Rao's for the first time the other night. A buddy of mine took me to Rao's, and that restaurant, they have that sound. They have that noise. There's a restaurant in Barcelona called Cal Pep. And that was the first time I really kind of was brought in tune to that noise. And it's just like the perfect mesh of like people talking, music in the background, glasses clinking, you know, it's just this weird thing. And Balthazar has it really, really well. And I'd like to say the Meatball Shop has it, as well, you know. And I think that like when I walk into a restaurant and I feel that, I know I'm in a good place.
Well, can you believe the show is finished?
I
can you believe, wow, that we've just by. Been like 45 minutes and you just hit it. Well, I everybody out there, if you have not been, you have to go. What's the, give the three addresses in New York City.
84 Stanton Street,
that's Lower East Side.
64 Greenwich, on Greenwich Avenue in the West Village, 170 Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and coming soon to 200 9th Avenue in Chelsea.
22nd Street.
22nd, yeah.
We're still waiting on the mascot there.
www.themeatballshop.com for apparel, great gifts, and wonderful time.
Buy the Meatball Shop cookbook for all your Christmas gifts.
If you want to bring the meatballs back to your own home, you can buy the Meatball Shop cookbook. Michael Chernow will sign it for you.
Daniel's Hanukkah special, the meatball.
I'm
waiting for the fish balls, guys.
We got fish balls. We have veggie balls for the vegetarians.
You better make those fish balls, my man.
Okay, well, thanks for coming today, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.